Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Exodus chapter 27, verse 20, through chapter 30, verse 10. I'm not reading the whole thing, but a certain section here I'm going to be reading to you today, and we're focusing on a few details. So this Torah portion covers mostly or dominantly, it covers the high priest and his garments, as well as the process of anointing Aaron. And mind you, this stuff isn't actually occurring yet. This is what God is explaining to Moses to do. So all this stuff gets repeated later on in our Torah portion. Later on in the Torah. So this is an initial description that God's giving as far as what Moses is writing down to do. Then later on, it'll actually be done and people participate. So the second part we're going to cover a little bit about as far as portion we're going to read today. We're going to start out reading basically the tail end of 27 and a good percentage or so of chapter 28. Just so you have a feel with parts we're going to be covering a little bit. So starting in 27, starting in verse 20. Now you should command the children of Israel that they shall take for you pure olive oil pressed for illumination to kindle a lamp continually in the tent of meeting outside the partition that is near the testimonial tablets. Aaron and his sons shall arrange it from evening until morning before Jehovah, an eternal decree for the generations from the children of Israel. I'm going to stop there for a moment here. Because we're changing topics. This portion of our Torah portion discusses a few things. A lamp, which regards obviously our menorah, which was mentioned in the last Torah portion, is the first few verses and will be re-brought up again in a secondary subject matter toward the tail of the Torah portion in chapter 30. So this is a new topic. So going from chapter 27, there's just a few details to recall. This concept of the press illumination to kindle the lamp continually. Well, in our English concept of continue means never ending. So you light the lamp and you never let it go out. If it rains or no, protect it. No, that's not what continually means. Continually means on a regular basis. So much like you continually go to work on your job, right? You're not working 24/7 nonstop, you'd all be dead. But you continually go to your job on a regular basis. That's the idea of continuous. It's not never ending, meaning that you will never have time to function, but rather you will do it and then you will not do it and go back and forth on a regular basis. So he lights it roughly around 3 o'clock or so in the afternoon, is the most common time slot, and then it is put out in the morning. Days. For all 7 days of the week, that's what he does, including Shabbat. 7 days, that's what it's continuously doing. Non-stop forever, it just means you will go on continually. So if God says I'm going to do something for forever, it doesn't mean, well, he'll do it today and then the next minute, every minute continuously. He means on a regular basis, without an end. So it will go on for eternity, for the holy days, Shabbat, which says your requirement for forever. Yeah, so Shabbats and holy days, all those things are based on a regular basis. So you have, every Shabbat will go on for all eternity, mean as in gazillion years, all eternity. But it's every week, not every day. Shabbats every week. So that type of thing is continuously. So when you think about those lamps or anything God says continuously, that's what he's referring to on a regular basis. Now let's move forward. Chapter 28. You will bring near yourself Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him from among the children of Israel. Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and Eleazar, and Itamar, the sons of Aaron, to minister to me. You should make vestments of sanctity for Aaron, your brother, and for the glory and splendor. You shall speak to all the wise-hearted people from whom I have invested with the spirit of wisdom, and they shall make the vestments of Aaron to sanctify him to minister to me. These the vestments they shall make: a breastplate, an ephod, a robe, a tunic of a box-like knit, a turban, and a sash. You should make vestments of Aaron for your brother and his sons to minister to me. They should take the gold, the turquoise, the purple, and scarlet, and linen. So we ask ourselves, oh wait, so we're going to make all these clothing for Aaron. Why? Why does it matter what he's dressed in? His best, it's God's best, if God's designing it, of course. He's doing it obviously for people to identify or recognize that's a high priest, because not everybody necessarily would know you by name or by sight, right? I don't know Joe Blow walking on the street, but if he's dressed out and decked out in a particular outfit, I might, hey, guess what? Joe Blow is the high priest. I would spot that. And that's useful, right? Not that Joe Blow, the other one. I might recognize in that way. So these are obviously designed for, to draw attention to. Don't ever forget, every description of the Torah, when it refers to the priest, it's always about your Messiah. It's your Messiah who's being described. All right? Not necessarily that Messiah is, meaning the Yeshua is dressed out in this outfit, per se. But the idea is to recognize what he looks like continuously. To always be aware of where he is, what he's doing, and how he's functioning. When we go through our Torah portions and we read the concept of anointing someone, any like these, which we're going to read about today, the anointing of the high priests, that anointing is a Messiah-ing, or making them a Messiah. Because Mashiach means to anoint. So Yeshua HaMashiach, Yeshua the Anointed One. Well, every time you have someone or a character being anointed, for whatever reason in your Torah portion of Tanakh anywhere, it is a reference what Messiah is supposed to do. It's a picture of him. So the high priest, as well as all of his sons, get anointed. Aaron gets anointed. There's a picture of your Messiah. Now, he gets anointed with all this garb on. We'll discuss that with, I'm not sure how he cleaned it later. The oil kind of does tend to stain, you know, certain garments. But that's what he's going to do. He's going to anoint with most of his garments on and get it all over his body and his clothing. And again, it's always a picture of your Messiah continuously, because that is what he is supposed to look like. So you would recognize him. Okay? Oh, yes.
I'm just trying to get the picture in my mind's eye and see if I'm understanding you right. So for me, like, Yeshua means salvation has come, correct? So these...
Okay.
Correct. So the name of God, always we know, is about a reputation. So what other attributes are we seeing of God in these pictures that, for me, it's like, all right, well, what am I supposed to be walking out? How am I supposed... What is this supposed to look like through the prism of love? So when people look upon me, they can see a wise and understanding people, what a God that they're calling his name, how great that God is, and that kind of drawing light. So is that
on the same line? In those lines, which we're going to talk about, some, not all, of these vestment items, they are designed to make us think about those particular characteristics. Not all of them. It's a little exhausting to go through every detail of this garment. I don't want to talk about that today at all, actually. It's something totally different in our Torah portion, but I have to cover these important things so they are relevant to your Messiah. So in some of these items we're going to cover and talk about, we're going to jump down a little bit on some of the components. The first thing we're going to jump to are actually the stones identify the names of people, names of tribes. Because although I could talk about his robe and the different garments and the bells and such at the bottom, those are not the topic I want to focus on, because those items, no offense to people's opinions, are items, they're objects. They have their function, they have their symbolism. But I want to focus on the things that our Torah portion actually tells us what the symbol is. Because there's some things we're not told what the symbol is. We have to infer that or gather from all the other Torah portion sections or all the rest of the Tanakh. But there's certain parts our Torah actually says, this is what this symbol means. It's very convenient that way. So jump to verse 9, please, of chapter 28. One of the components which is on his outfit. You should take the two Shoham stones. Some argue it's onyx. We don't know. By the way, the stones listed here in your Torah portion, there is no human on earth who has any clue what any of them are. No human on earth has any idea what they are. They're not written down anywhere. The language and the terms are all lost. So your Bibles interpret some as sapphire and all these other things. We're guessing. It's strictly a guess, okay? Because we don't know. So Shoham stones, and engrave upon them the names of the sons of Israel, six other names on one stone, and the names of six remaining ones on the other stone, according to the order of their birth. So he has two stones, six on one and the other. The jeweler's craft, like the engraving of the signet ring, you shall engrave the two stones, the names of the sons of Israel, encircled with gold settings shall you make them. You shall place both stones on the shoulder straps of the ephod, remembrance stones for the sons of Israel. Aaron shall carry the names before Jehovah on both his shoulders as a remembrance. So when we look at our Messiah, what is this function, one of these stones on each shoulder? What are the functions related to that? What does it symbolize? He's carrying the names of each of the tribes according to the order of their birth, from the oldest to the youngest, all the way through. So Reuben's number one goes all the way down to the last one, Benjamin, on his shoulders. When you imagine someone carrying a rock on one and a rock on the other shoulder, what do we think of? A burden. You're carrying a burden on their shoulders, right? So what is the burden that Messiah carries on his shoulders? All the children, their names. Now, we're not referring to sins necessarily. Their sins come in later. But this is their name. So this is their identities, what they are, how they live, how they interact with God, their needs. How many of you have burdens related to your family? Family needs this. Family needs that. Yeah, a whole lot of them. Some have more kids than others. Yeah, family needs. Yeah, we always need something. We need. And we need from our parents because we're young or we're older. Well, sometimes we still need it anyway. It varies some. Sometimes it never ends. But the idea is when you're carrying those burdens, those weights, you're carrying their needs. Because that is a burden upon every parent. It's a willing burden, but still a burden. It's their needs you're carrying. Not their sins, not the transgressions, not their iniquities. This is their needs. What do they need? We'll discuss what the needs are maybe later today. I'm not sure if we'll get to it or not. Needs can vary from a lot of things. We'll discuss that. I don't know if we'll get to it because there's something I want to talk about today that's nothing to do with this at all. But remember, so we have identified that we have the needs of these people, these children of Israel, and God made them put in their order of birthright. So that implies, because birthright means something to God in the order, certain children have more priority based on their birthright as given versus others, or more authority in that way. We may disagree, may not like that. Reality is, God set it up that way. So you put them in order according to their birthright. So their needs are weighed that way. And of course, the high priest, our Messiah, carries them to God. He's the burden carrier of these needs. The second thing we're going to talk about is the other list that has all the names on it, which of course is the stones on the breastplate. So jump to verse 15. A breastplate of judgment. You shall make a breastplate of judgment of a woven design, like the craftsman of the ephod, you shall make it, of gold, turquoise, purple, and scarlet wool and linen. Twist it together, you shall make it. Square shall it be, folded, its length half cubit, its width half cubit. You shall fill it with stone mounting, four rows of stone, a row of odim. I'm going to read these, mind you. I realize that I know what most of them are. Of odim, pita, barakes, one row. And the second row is nofech, sofar, and yashalom. The third row, leshem, shavo, and achlama. And the fourth row, tarshish, shoham, and yashfe. Set in gold, there should be their mountings. The stones should be according to the names of the sons of Israel. No, this is not in order of their birthright. This is just names of Israel. 12 according to their names, engraved like a signet ring, each according to its name shall they be for the 12 tribes. So in this case, we have these same stones, a new set of stones. They're in sets of, they're obviously written in sets, the rows. The names are engraved on each stone. Each tribe has its name engraved on each of the stones. We don't know which one's which. You could argue maybe it's in order or not. We don't know which one's which stone corresponds to who. But each one of the stones has a name engraved on it for each of the stones, each of the names of the tribes of Israel. And verse 22, for the breastplate you shall make, change the edges. we'll read through this a little bit. Change the edges of a braided craftsman of pure gold. For the breastplate, you should make two rings of gold to place the two rings, the two ends of breastplate. Let's skip through some of the stuff. No offense, I'm not going to discuss the details of how it's mounted. Let's jump to verse 29. Aaron shall bear the names of the sons of Israel on the breastplate of judgment on his heart when into the sanctuary as a constant remembrance before Jehovah. So we learned about the stones with the names written in the order on the shoulders, which we understand those are needs or wants or burdens for the parent, in this case, Messiah, to carry. And this list is different. What's different about it? They're individual stone. Each one has their own individual identity of what's what. Some argue it has a letter of the tribe. Some think it's a full name of each tribe. It doesn't make a difference. The point is that each one has its own representation. And where is it held? Across his heart. Now, is that different than on his shoulders? What's different? Votion versus physical?
Do you make any connection with covenant and the tablets of stone with these?
The stones?
And the 12 stones. There was no, apart from the written tablets, they didn't have a literary, they didn't have alphabets. And so was this an outward expression of the covenant?
In the form of these stones, because we have the few examples of the tribes of Israel with given a stone identity, are given for the building of the tabernacle and the 12 gates and such in the old verse that it describes in Ezekiel, which is part of the Haftorah reading portion today, discussing this. So we have to imply or guess that God is identifying each stone as an entrance point or a way to the inner sanctuary of God. Now, when we think of somebody getting into myself, getting into it, they got into my heart, didn't they? Someone gets into your heart. You have a heart for them. So in a way of inner speaking, those gates, which all have a stone corresponding to them and a name assigned to them, are the way into God's personal sanctuary, his personal home, his personal inner being. It's the same imagining of God's of Messiah, or the high priest, his stones. There are ways into the Messiah's heart, each access.
He's showing them he's committed by having them do this. So I'm committed to opening my heart to each one of these tribes and covenant.
Right. That is what he's doing. It's a symbolism, of course, but that's what he's doing. So he understands we have that he has the weight of their burdens, their needs on his shoulders he carries, and each one has a special access point into his heart, a special kindness or favor that he has toward them. It's so different that you have kindness and favor to your children. Each child has its own way of getting into their parent's heart. Their needs or their love for that child is unique in each one of them. Well, that's the same way that Messiah has with his examples. We have these examples of each one of them as covering his heart in that same general way.
Is it in Revelation where the Lord will give us a new name?
We're going to discuss names shortly. It's not part of this section of our Torah portion. We'll discuss it in probably about 15 minutes from now. Because God names people certain things. So let's move forward a little bit here. So we have this understanding of these stones, and of course God gives the symbols of them, carrying the burdens of the children on their shoulders, as well as they will cover his heart, inside of his heart, as far as an access point when he approaches God. So he always has these things on him. Going down to verse 30. So he wants, from, we were just reading verse 29, now go to verse 30 of Exodus 28. It says, in the breastplate of judgment, you shall place the Urim and Thummim, and they shall be on Aaron's heart when he comes before Jehovah, and Aaron shall bear the judgment of the children of Israel on his heart constantly before Jehovah. So now he has not only the names are on his heart, but also tucked inside, because this is a pocket, a folded over sheet of fabric, inside of it is tucked the Urim and Thummim, which is the judgment or a method by which you would communicate with God to get an answer. is also tucked in them. So when you have these heart things, mind you, I use this example regularly when it comes to parent and child. When a child needs something or a child has this desire to love their parent, but they have some problem, something they've done, they shouldn't have done, so that you know you've done something wrong and it's a problem. We have to address this. And your child comes to you, this might be referring to an adult, more of an adult child so much as a child, a little one, but same concept. You have these ideas that they come to their parents, they love them, the parent loves them back. But there's also some things that have to be addressed. Things have to be taken care of. Healing has to happen. Correction has to happen. Fixing emotions, wrecked problems, wrecked everything. Because it happens a lot. Our wrecked relations with our parents happen a lot. Well, God's all about reconciliation, fixing those wrecked relationships.
Daniel, Richard, your dad taught us that the Thurman is truth and that the Urim is light. So he uses truth and light to teach us.
In Jewish tradition, Urim, they're guessing it comes Urim from Ur, meaning light, and Urim means plural of lights. And Tumim is supposed to be complete or something that's finished. And they get, well, something is complete or finished, it has to be correct or standing upright or being justified in some way. And it's a fair, reasonable interpretation. We don't know for certain whether that's their official title or not, but that's what they're used for. So it is a light or an idea of, it gives you one of the traditional viewpoints, the idea of light and something that is light is corrected. Because when you have a problem, what do we learn about sin? Sin hates light, doesn't it? But when you have an issue with your parent that you need correction, you actually have to bring it out. Say, let's talk about this and put this on the table to discuss. We have to fix this. We have to fix this, which that's what you're doing. When you're going to God, does God not know everything? He already knows it, but you have to believe, okay, God, let's handle this problem so I may be at one with you again. So it's a continuous idea. And of course, you bring it into light to bring it out to talk about it. And now let's dream, complete this. Let's set this right. Let's fix this situation that I may be at one with my God, be in my God's heart, or with the concept, enter into the temple of my God. Because mind you, these stones are also gates. They're gateways in the temple. So maybe I enter in with God and be at one with my house, my God's house. Be at one with him. Same idea, same symbolism. This is all about our Messiah. It's the nature of what our Messiah is supposed to do. Now, these ideas, of course, are not my inventions. They're mostly from Ezekiel because he was a very smart person. But anyway, he talks about a lot of these details. Let's move on a little bit further because I want to talk about a little bit today. Actually, before we move on, there's something about the Urim and Thummim. No one has any clue how they worked. It doesn't matter. We have no idea how they worked. People guess it. A lot of guesses. Was it letters being lit up? Was it names? And who knows? It doesn't matter. But it is a method by which which you communicate with God in some way or another, which you communicate or make right or make complete or stand upright the way which it has been. So God can use these tools, and he has, and he does so at different times. We're not going to discuss all of them, but just give you a heads up. I'm sure most of you remember this. You remember Saul, King Saul? Yeah. What were the big corrections and screw-ups he did to the tail end of his life? Remember that? The witch Endor, all that stuff? You know, that he consulted all that stuff. Because God would not answer Saul's questions using the Urim. The Urim. It records that Saul asked God, he wouldn't talk to him in visions, or dreams, or answer his difficult questions with the Urim. What does that tell you about the relationship between God and Saul? It was not going to be set right. It was not going to be fixed or corrected. It was not going to be judged properly, meaning rectified. It had to end. The relationship had to end. And what did the relationship do? Of course, Saul perishes. How it ends. So we learn that Saul, the priestly tool, it is a tool to be used, but Saul was unable to use it. Now he was able to use it previously, but not at that time. Unable to use it. So that was an instance where you couldn't use it. The Urim's also used as it records that the Torah commands it's used for difficult things. Like, you know, there's a dead body out there. Not sure who did it. Could be person A or person B. We don't know. We can't prove it. No witnesses. But we know one of them did it. Both said they didn't. We have no idea. Can't evidence. No proof at all. And you can't get any convincing. Nothing. No breaking of them. That can't happen. You go to the priest. Say, okay, God, what do we do? What do we do? How do we fix this? Who's guilty? Who do we punish? And then the Urim is used for that. That's recorded in Deuteronomy 17. That's what it's used for. Things that are difficult that we cannot figure out with all of our technique, all of our tools, all of our investigative abilities, cannot figure out what is actually the case. God answered. Now, God gives a stipulation. I'll answer it. And in Deuteronomy 17, it records, you must do exactly what I say, no deviations. That's important because it doesn't matter who's guilty or who's innocent. If God says, do this to so-and-so, person A, they may not have even committed the murder. Doesn't matter. If God says, do this to so-and-so, person A, you are not allowed to deviate, else you're executed. You must follow the rules. I say, well, why would God do that? Why would he just say, so-and-so's guilty? He's smarter than I am. He's smarter than you are. There are things far bigger than the single dead body out there that we don't know about. But you must never deviate. Once you ask God's instructions and he gives you the answers and he says, they will tell you exactly what to do. According to my words, they will. You cannot deviate. You must follow them, whatever they are. It could be something simple like go stand on your head for 10 hours. That's hard to do. Get wrong. It doesn't make a difference. Whatever he says, you cannot deviate. If you do, you're guilty of a death penalty. It's important to understand that when you ask God, God rules. You don't.
Okay, help me where it is exactly, because for some reason I'm getting the correlation where Saul is judging the two women with the baby. Solomon, excuse me, he's going to cut the kid in half. How does that relate to this?
The story? That was a brilliant technique that he used in order to convince, because he worked off the emotions and the thought processes of inside of a new mom. Now, I don't understand those things. No offense. I'm not that smart. I love my wife, but the thought process of inside of a new mother, what's the mother going to think and how she's going to react? God gave Solomon great wisdom to be able to know what a real mother's going to do. I wouldn't have guessed that, but he did. So I don't know how that would necessarily relate to this instance, but other than the fact that King ordered it to be done this way. Now he says in Deuteronomy 17, when they go to the priest gives a list. The priest tells you whatever the God says, and you have to obey the priest. It says, or the judge, which means the priest may delegate, hey, this is what happened, Judge B, whatever your name is. You are now going to carry this stuff out to make sure this event happens. And judges, Mishpatim, they are responsible for communities. That includes a king is classified as the judge category. So when a judge dictates something happened, it has to happen according to the judge's words. You can't deviate from them either. The same principle as God commands. Just if you go to the priest rattles off what the solution is through the Urim and Thummim, and then the judge has to make sure it gets carried out because the priest is busy. He's going to sit there and babysit you all the way through the process. Assign some responsible party to make sure this task, whatever it is completed and make sure it's done. And you have to follow suit. In any case, in that instance, I would say Solomon would probably follow under the judge category, not as a high priest, but as a judge category that it was brought to him because he was not using the Urim to figure that out. He used his own intelligence and knowledge and God's wisdom to manipulate two women and see how they would react. The wisdom going for God is a correlation. You always go through the judgments. Let's move forward a little bit. I want to go through all of them because there's other things that the Urim and Thummim are used for as well. Mostly dominant to use or communicate with God. If you don't have one, it's a problem. Including today, we don't have one, so it's a problem. But let's move forward a little bit. I want to go through another topic a little bit before I get to that's not fair. This part is kind of blended together. So this next section is two parts, but it's going to be the same. They're all covering the same topic. So in Exodus 28, there was a verse there that all of you are know very well because you heard it multiple times. Exodus 28, verse 36. You shall make a head plate of pure gold. You shall engrave upon it, engraving like a signet ring, Holy Jehovah. You've read that before. Where have you read that before? Remember? Where does that show up before? Again, in your Tanakhs. Anybody recall? It's a prophet says it. It's with a Z. Zechariah. Ezekiel starts an E. Good guess, but they sound similar. Zechariah 14 talks about the same topic, and he talks about it very specifically. And this is where we're going to go to a more interesting discussion today. So, we had to ask ourselves, when the Bible repeats a particular phrase, this is, by the way, this is a unique phrase. It's not used everywhere, only certain spots. It's probably because it's trying to tie them together. Most commonly, like, for example, if I tie the word Shabbat to rest or a peace, to rest, they're probably tied together. So if I come back, oh, so-and-so's finally at rest, we get the idea of being at peace or being at rest. We tie them together. It's the same idea. Well, Holiness of the Lord is obviously only tied a few spots. In particular, obviously, it's going to be Zechariah. Zechariah talks about this. He talks about it in a fashion that is very different than the Torah. Zechariah chapter 14. Let's see, we will go to... We'll jump to verse 20. Well, let's back a little bit. That's not fair. Let's just go start at verse 16 so we know what we're talking about when we go through verse the tail end. Zechariah chapter 14, starting in verse 16. It shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the king and Jehovah of hosts, to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the king, the Jehovah, the Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain. If the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague with which Jehovah strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. In that day, holiness to Jehovah shall be engraved on the bells of the horses, on the pots in the Lord's house, Jehovah's house, shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yes, every pot in Jerusalem and Judah shall be holiness to Jehovah, the Lord of hosts. Everyone who sacrifices shall come and take them and cook in them. In that day, there shall no longer be a Canaanite, which a merchant or a pagan, in the house of Jehovah of hosts. So, High Priest Aaron is stamped with this name on his forehead, or roughly around his forehead. Holy to Jehovah. I mean, set aside for God. That's what the point is, holy to Jehovah. And then later on, Zechariah's course referring to the, I guess we call it the third till period, or the everlasting one that we're all waiting for. Every bell, every pot of everything that's is all labeled the same thing, holy to God. So he transfers this identity from Messiah as a unique identifier marker to every pot and every bowl that ever sacrifices to Jehovah. In the entire city of Jerusalem, mind you. That's what Zechariah is talking about. The whole city is listed that way. So all the stuff, everything in there is all that way. We ask ourselves, how'd that happen? How did you go from the holiest individual of a man can be, and that holiness being your high priest, Messiah himself, being spread out amongst all the stuff that every person like me or you or her or anybody can use? And how did that holiness get transferred over to all these things that are used? Well, Jerusalem isn't the same as the temple, is it? No, it's not. They're different. Jerusalem city, temple's a building in the city. But yet the holiness spreads out from temple and spreads out to all Jerusalem. How's that possible? How'd that happen? It's a new Jerusalem. There's just something unique about this particular one, which Ezekiel talks about as well as, of course, our book of Revelation talks about the same thing. The new Jerusalem idea. Something is different or unique about this scenario because something has now spread out from being an individual, the high priest, to now spread out to everybody who enters Jerusalem can now attach themselves. Mind you, are horses clean or unclean animals? Unclean. But yet they get the same title written on their bridles and on their bells, everything they use. That unclean individual, the horse, is now just as holy, just as clean, just as righteous as high priest himself. Yeah, what? How could that happen? This doesn't make any sense. Well, not clean means not food, because guess what? Humans aren't clean either. Are we? We're not clean either. We're human. We're not supposed to eat ourselves, right? Because we're not clean. Well, that's the whole reason. But the point is, the idea is you don't eat humans because they're not clean either. We're not, but yet we're allowed to go in. This is worth our study. This is worth something to look into. Why is this? And it has to do with a particular name. Now, I am not the one who pointed this out. A couple years back, Jimmy Gordon pointed this out a few years ago. Three years ago, something like that. He pointed this out, that it's a name identifier. Now, he didn't present it in the way I'm going to present to you now, but he pointed this out to me. Mind you, he is leaps and bounds smarter than I am. And everything as far as what he studies, because mind you, he has degrees in this topic. He's very, very well versed. But he points something out to us. And here is our answer. Let's jump to our Haftor portion, Ezekiel 43. So Ezekiel chapter 43. Yeah, I get that. Yeah. We'll all get there. 43, Ezekiel 43. I'm not reading the entire Haftor portion. I'm reading a couple verses. Two verses. All right? 43. Now, mind you, I'll read a few more verses, just two. I'll start at verse 13. But this whole event, Ezekiel 40, a few chapters earlier, he starts recording out all the dimensions of the structure of the third temple, the inner sanctuary, the outer sanctuary, the curtains, everything, without curtains, sorry, all the buildings, the whole works, the whole big picture. It's a massive thing. We're discussing all those details. Our Torah portion, we're going to focus on something strange. So in chapter 43, starting in verse 13, this is the altar. Now, mind you, this altar is not the incense altar. This altar is the one which you burn animals on. There's two. Well, one's incense for prayers, and one's animals for offering sacrifices. Verse 13. These are the measurements, the altar in cubits. The cubit is one cubit and a hand breadth. The base of one cubit high, and the one cubit wide, with a rim all around its edge, one span. This is the height of the altar. From the base, the ground, lower ledge, two cubits, the width of the ledge, one cubit. From the smaller ledge to the larger ledge, four cubits, and the width of the ledge, one cubit. The altar hearth is four cubits high, with four horns extending upward from the hearth. The altar hearth is 12 cubits long, 12 wide, square at its four corners. Stop. That's in English. In English, that's what it reads. I'm going to read it in English again, but I'm going to change the words on a few things. In verse 14 and verse 15, which will help explain where we're going to go to. I'm going to skip verse 13 because I'm going to continue on. So in verse 15, it says, the Ariel Harel is four cubits high, with four horns extending upward from the Ariel. The Ariel Harel is 12 cubits long, 12 wide, square at its four corners. Now, most would say, so? You're saying Hebrew words, right? Okay. He pointed this out. He's smarter than I am because I didn't catch it, because I read English, not Hebrew. And we heard the term Ariel. Like, think Little Mermaid. Think Little Mermaid. Ariel. Sebastian has a funny accent, right? Ariel. It's a boy's name, by the way, not a girl's name. Dizzy screwed up. Ariel's a boy's name. Ari, lion. El, God. What does Ariel mean? Lion of God. Now, this is a title. It's a name. Your English Bibles will translate that as altar. That is not the name for altar. It isn't. Ariel is a name. Like as in, I call you, you know, Sean. That's your name, right? I don't say man. Well, you are, but I don't use that. It's a thing. You have a name, right? Well, Ariel, that's a name. Not altar, it's a name. Now, Ariel, Har-El, which your Bible translates as hearth. Har comes the word mount or mountain, and El, God. So, lion of God, the mountain of God. That's the title given to this altar. Now, it's not the title given to the altar during Moses' time, but it's given here in Ezekiel's time. We just ask ourselves, why would God name it? What does that matter? Why does he name it? Does it have to have a name? He could have just said the place, the altar where the fire goes. it's the heart, the hot spot, the part where you put the logs and such down. That's where it's at. But he names it and gives it a name. And it's important we understand this name because that helps explain what happens. And with Zechariah, with the whole everything being spread out. So we're gonna write this down a little bit. Do I have a projector up there? It does work. Okay. So Ariel. Oops, A-L. I will fix that. Rotate like. There. Ariel R. So this is lion. Of God. And this one is mountain. Of God. Or you can say mount of God. It basically means the tall mound of dirt that is hard to climb where God's at. Now, when I say mountain of God, what image should come into your mind? No, mountain of God, out of God, as in like the creator. Zion, Mount Zion, where the Ten Commandments came down. That's where you, the mountain of God, the mountain of God is always Mount Zion or Mount Horeb, the different names. Sinai. Sorry, you're right. Sorry, I misheard you. Sinai, apologize. Sinai. Thank you. Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai, the place where, what did the people see when they saw that mountain? Burning fire, right? It's heat. It's hot. Don't go up there. It melts rocks. It's really, really hot, right? So we have the hearth of an altar. It makes sense. Oh, that's where the hot stuff is at. That's where your coals, your fire, your wood, your coal, they burn stuff that you put down. It makes sense that you translate the word mountain of God as a hearth, a burning furnace, a hot furnace. It makes sense why they would translate that, which is nothing wrong with that. And God is consuming fire and he consumes those who go against him. But in this phrase, when God decides to title something Lion of God, the Mountain of God, and he gives it to this name to this particular object, which is an altar, we have to ask ourselves, why did he choose to name it? Because when you name something, think of Adam and Eve, when you name something, what are you doing? You are demonstrating your dominion over it. When you name something, when I say that is a cow or heifer, what do you want to call it? I am identifying it. This is its name. I am giving it this name. If I name the cow Bessie, I am indicating that it is an affectionate term, that I am now taking this cow as if it is my own. I am identifying my control or ownership over the cow.
So it's not an altar, you said, though, before. It's not the word is not altar. So we think of the altars, you know, where the animal was slaughtered. So is it the same object?
It is.
It's just the mountain of God.
It is the Lion of God the mountain of God. So that's only those two verses. Before that, it's offering the altar. That's correct. Altar, altar, altar. Its name is Ariel, Har-El, Ariel, Har-El. And then it continues on, altar, 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 altar. So we identify it as the altar, which animals are burned on, but God gave it a name, Ariel, Har-El.
Okay, so the Lion of God is Yeshua, and Yeshua, the Lion of Judah. All right, so the lion, Ariel, was slaughtered on the altar. And that is...
We'll discuss that. That's what we're going to.
That's what we're talking about. That's what we're talking about today. What does this mean? What does this mean?
I don't know if this matters or not, but a mountain of God, the consuming fire, or has this possibly been a volcano?
I don't think so, because it says it came down from the top down, I suppose. The Mount Sinai wasn't a volcano. It's still argued. Well, I shouldn't say that. I don't know how it was formed. I wasn't there. But if I was there, it probably wasn't a volcano. I wasn't around, you know, 18,000 years ago. What was that? Archaeology. I don't know about those details. I'm not a geologist or anything, but I don't know how it was formed, so I can't speak that. But when I think of with the mountain of God, it's supposed to, the symbolism given in Exodus was the whole big fire burning atop the mountain because it's the cloud and such, all the lightning and the big trumpets, all that stuff, where he gives the Ten Commandments. That's what we're referring to. Power. That's what the idea is. The idea of lion is also used for strength, so that it is very ferocious, very dominant, like a warrior or something similar. Same idea. That's the idea of mountain, of great strength of it. Why would God name it this way? And how does this name correlate or make any sense with holiness to Jehovah being spread about from the high priest's identifier through to all the people? That's given to us by Isaiah. Isaiah explains why Ariel and holiness to Jehovah, being Jerusalem, all based in Jerusalem, are connected. So let's go to Isaiah. So Isaiah 29. Isaiah 29. Now, I'm not sure about all your English Bibles, but this is how it's supposed to read. So Isaiah 29, we're going to go through the first 12 verses. Woe to Ariel! To Ariel, the city where David dwelt. Isaiah 29. That was verse 1. Where the city where David dwelt. Add years to years, let feasts come around, yet I will distress Ariel. God is giving the name Jerusalem a different name in Isaiah 29. It's a prophetic name. He named it Ariel. The same name, years later, he gives to his altar, Ariel. All right? So Jerusalem and God's altar, where altars, animals go up, he is connecting by giving them both the same name. All right? By the way, thank you for the marker. That helps read better. Continue on. Yet I will distress Ariel, verse 2, there shall be heaviness and sorrow, and it shall be to me as Ariel. I will encamp against you all around. I will lay siege against you with a mound. I will raise siege works against you. You shall be brought down. You shall speak out of the ground. Your speech shall be low out of the dust. Your voice shall be like a medium's out of the ground, and your speech shall whisper out of the dust. Moreover, the multitude of your foes shall be like fine dust. The multitude of the terrible ones shall be chafe as that pass away. Yes, it shall be in an instant. Suddenly, you will be punished by Jehovah of hosts with thunder, with earthquake, with great noise, with storm and tempest, and the flame devouring fire. The multitude of all the nations who fight against Ariel, even all who fight against her and her fortresses and her and distress her, should be as a dream of a night vision. It shall even be as if a hungry man dreams, and look, he eats in his dream, but he awakes and his soul is still empty. Or as when a thirsty man dreams and dreams he's drinking, But he awakes. Indeed, he is still faint. His soul still craves. So the multitude of all the nations who will fight against Mount Zion. Pause and wonder. Blind yourselves and be blind. They are drunk, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with intoxicating drink. For Jehovah has poured out on you the spirit of deep sleep. He has closed your eyes, namely the prophets. He has covered your heads, namely the seers. The whole vision has become to you like the words of a book that is sealed, which men deliver to one who is illiterate, saying, "Read this, please." So they cannot, it is sealed. Then the book is delivered to one who is illiterate, saying, "Read this, please." And he cannot. I'm illiterate. In that prophecy that Isaiah gives in chapter 29, God is identifying Jerusalem as Ariel. Now, when you put, I'm asking this practical question. Let's pretend you have a barbecue and you have a fire and it's going. And you pour dirt and dust all over it. What happens to the fire? It goes out. So what's God saying, Jerusalem? I'm putting my fire out. I'm putting the altar, Ariel, I'm putting my fire out. I'm going to quench it. I'm shutting it off. You're going to go to sleep, to be illiterate. Can a fire relight itself? No, it requires heat, something to make itself relight. You can't light yourself up. So the illiterate man cannot read. The sealed book cannot be unsealed. The idea is that God is identifying his altar, Ariel, with Jerusalem, Ariel. He's putting Jerusalem to sleep. What did he do to his altar, by the way? Remember Nebuchadnezzar? What did he do to Jerusalem in the temple? He burned it to the ground. It was put out. It was destroyed. It was ruined. It was made laid waste. So just like God is doing, and he took Jerusalem at the same time. So he used Nebuchadnezzar to take out both his altar and Jerusalem and shut them down. It was an empty city, truly asleep for like 70 years, for a very long time. That's how God did it. That was his plan. So we see that God is identifying Ariel, his altar, and Ariel, Jerusalem, as the same thing. He views them the same way. It's important to understand that because this helps explain what Zechariah and this holiness to Jehovah explain or mean. The first was in Ezekiel. Ezekiel recorded Ariel, that was in 43, and then we just went through Isaiah 29, which also discusses Ariel. So identify that Ariel, God is naming his altar and Jerusalem the same prophetic name. It was Ezekiel 43, verses 14 and 16. Hold on a minute. Yes.
The meaning of Ariel, you said, was the lion of God. So are you maybe making a connection that he's shutting down Messiah?
Sort of.
Not Messiah. Messiah's lion of Judah, not Lion of God. They're different. Different titles. He names them differently. So we're going to now explain how is this connected together with our Torah portion of wholeness to Jehovah. So let's go to Book of Revelation because that helps tie it together a little bit. And by the way, I like when God changes names up, it's very, very interesting. That's why I study those things. So that's what I like to do. So, Revelation 21. Let's jump to verse 9. That's fine. Verse 9 of 21. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came to me and talked to me, saying, "Come, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife." He carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. Now, mind you, stop for a minute. Isaiah, we learned that in God's viewpoint, Jerusalem's name is Ariel. All right? In our Bibles, we call it Jerusalem, but God views it, its name is the Lion of God. That is its name. It's a title. So Holy Jerusalem or Holy Lion of God. the sending out from heaven from God. Having the glory of God, her light was like, almost like a precious stone, like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. She was at a great and high wall with 12 gates, 12 angels, the gates, the names written on them, which are the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. Stop. That kind of corresponds to the 12 stones on the breastplate. Now, mind you, the stones, the idea of getting into the high priest, getting into his heart, getting into a parent's heart or a older brother's heart. Also, 12 gates you into the Jerusalem, into the city of Jerusalem. So we have this symbolism or similar symbolism. Three gates to the east, three gates to the north, three gates to the south, three gates to the west. Now, the wall of the city had 12 foundations. On them written the names of the 12 prophets of the Lamb. Again, same idea. We have the 12, consisting of 12 stones of names. Of course, these are 12 prophets, mind you, but it's still the same idea of names being written down on these stones. He walked, he had a gold reed to measure the city and its gates and its walls. The city laid out as a square, its length, its breadth, as great as its breadth. Measure the city, the reed, 12,000 furlongs, its length, breadth, and height are equal. He measured its wall, 140 cubits, according to the measurement of a man, that is of an angel. And the construction of its wall was of jasper. The city was of pure gold, like clear glass. The foundation of the wall, the city were adorned with all kinds of precious stones. The foundation was, again, a lot of lists of stones. Jasper, sapphire, chardonnay, emerald, sardis, chrysolite, beryl, topaz, jacinth, and amethyst. Yeah, I know most of these because they're in Greek. They kind of know what these stones are. I don't know if they're the same stones recorded in Torah. It doesn't matter. See one in verse 21. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each individual gate was one pearl. And the street of the city was pure gold like transparent glass. Verse 22. But I saw no temple in it. For Jehovah God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. And the city had no need of the sun or the moon to shine it. For the glory of God illuminated it, and the Lamb is its light. Stop for a minute. We'll come back there in a minute. So, if there's no temple in it, and there's 12 gates in it, and God and Messiah are in it, and there's no temple, mind you, there's no temple, what did Jerusalem just then become? The entire house of God. He took the temple, which was a small building, well, it's a big building, inside of a city of Jerusalem. Now, in this explanation, we see that when he's here, when he's on earth, he rebuilds it, New Jerusalem, the temple's removed, the whole city becomes a temple, right? But we're allowed to go in. If we're allowed to go in, that means I'm allowed to go into what is holy to Jehovah. I'm allowed to go into a space that the high priest, or the priests in general, are the only ones who went into. But I'm allowed to go in there. But it's an entire city, not just me. There are hundreds of thousands of, if not millions of people, are allowed to go in there. Now that kind of helps us picture Zechariah's explanation. There are so many bowls and vessels and products and items needed, all holy to Jehovah, in this space, in Jerusalem, as Zechariah says, because he's identifying the entire city becomes the holy temple. Everything in it is just like it was with the temple and the tent during Aaron's time. It's no longer just the breastplate, the headplate. It's all the objects are holy. So when God is explaining that Ariel, his great lion of God, his altar, is the same as Jerusalem, and he makes his altar, which was a small thing, roughly the size of this table, the size of Jerusalem, the entire city, including everybody in it. That's how we understand and see how God views Jerusalem as the burning fire of his altar. That offering that we give. We're not finished reading. We'll read there. Can you want? Yes, you question on your face. No? Just curious? Okay. So we have these again. Let's continue on here in Revelation. We were verse 24. Mind you, don't forget what we read in Zechariah 14 about the kings coming to give their glory and such. Verse 24 says, the nations of those who are saved shall walk in its light, the kings of the earth shall bring their glory and honor into it. Stop. That was the same thing described in Zechariah 14. The nations must bring their offerings. Mind you, what goes on the altar? Your offering, your animal offering, your best you have goes there. That's your glory and your honor are going there. So you know what? Its gates should not be shut at all by day, and there should be no night there. They shall bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it. But there should be no means to enter anything that defiles or causes abomination or a lie, but only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Because who's allowed in the temple? Those who are holy, right? Well, who's allowed in Jerusalem? Those who are holy, right? In the altar, Ezekiel gives us, they're designed for offering up your very best. The very best you have is given to God as a glory and honor to God. Well, both in Zechariah and Revelation says, your honor, everything you're giving is giving the very best. Glory, honor to God. But instead of on an altar like Ezekiel has it, it's the entire city that Zechariah and Revelation records it as. So God is metaphorically pointing out his altar is his entire city. That is his strength, the Lion of God. That's the power behind God. It's the people he's putting inside and he's offering, receiving these altars, receiving these offerings, these sacrifices. It's just through names, through use of naming, it helps identify the importance he put on things. We claim, I won't say right or wrong, we claim the sacrifices are all done away with. Really? No, they're not. Not at all. They're the same. You're giving your glory and honor is still done. It may not be an animal, but it's still done. It's still given, that same glory and honor still offered continuously, because that is, as he says, the Lion of God. That is the strength of warrior of God. Lion is used for warrior. That's how that is his desire and intense need, this intense fiery furnace that he named. So we have the symbolism of God's tying his altar with the entire city of Jerusalem. And as Zechariah points out, all the people in Jerusalem are included. And Revelation points out those who are not holy or honorable or not are disreputable individuals are not allowed in. But there are 12 gates. As we learn from the Urim and Tumim with the high priest, to be enter in, you must have your issues brought to light. Let's make these right. Let's correct these. Let's make these, as the Tumim says, corrected or completed. Straighten them up. Then come in. It's a beautiful, which is exactly what sacrifices are used for, mind you. When I sin, transgress iniquities, what am I doing? I bring a sacrifice to pay for so that I am right with God. It's the same process, the same symbol. It's used again and again and again. The idea is that is a never-ending concept, a never-ending step that every human must go through and continue to go through throughout our whole lives. The sacrifices never end. You always have to go back, okay, God, how to make this right? Let's do this right again to get the strength of God. I mean, enter your temple or enter the high priest, so to speak, his heart again.
So we've all been made priests. We've all been made priests through Yeshua. Right, which allows us to go to the city.
Right. Which is what we want. That's what you want. It doesn't matter if it's a horse, which is unclean. It's allowed in. So the same process that be allowed to go in is that stepping through that gate to be made right or made upright or straight or vertical, correct with God again. That's our goal. And we're allowed to enter. We're allowed to go through that process. So God had these plans and to be given them through step-by-step symbols through the prophets for a very long time. Unfortunately, some of our teachers have avoided that concept. And it's been frustrating because the idea that, oh, well, my sins are forgiven, I'm done. It's not. Sacrifices are a continuous, never-ending, step-by-step process. Because how many of us can say, I've never sinned since the last time? Well, yeah, we say it all the time. Well, that was yesterday. We're going to sin again, aren't we? Well, then we wouldn't allow it in. It's a continuous step-by-step process. And God had planned it out all the way from the very beginning when he discusses his altar and what it's there for. Altar is a symbolism or a type of, mind you, is perfectly square, just like Jerusalem is perfectly square, has the height of these three dimensions. So Jerusalem is perfectly dimensioned, the new Jerusalem, that is. It's all very, very well built, designed this way on purpose, not by accident. And mind you, Jerusalem is the square, not rectangular like the temple was built. Jerusalem's square like the altars are built. The temple was rectangular. Jerusalem is in the temple. The altar is square. The altar is what's square. That's the altar is actually both were square. So he didn't make it where it was the temple itself per se. It was the altar he was focused on. That is what Jerusalem looks like to him. Make sense? Any questions about this idea, this concept? Yes, Larry.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was studying this the other day, and they said people would be shocked. They think that God would not desire human sacrifice, and yet it's required. Yeah. All of us have to sacrifice. Ourselves.
I think Paul's commentary on what you're talking about is I have to die daily. I have put the deeds of the flesh to death daily.
The same process. You put it on the altar, you burn it up every time.
I mean, this whole concept is overwhelming to me, the responsibility, you know, that, and it's not that I'm personally responsible, but like, this is a gift. It's that's beyond my comprehension. I just can't, that's what's overwhelming me. So what's my response from inside? You're well, what sacrifices are we going to bring? Thanksgiving and praise.
Hosea records them. Your sacrifices of your lips, the bowls of your lips. And when I lift something up, I lift it with my words or my actions. Let's say I lift up joy, how great she is. I give great praise how wonderful of a daughter, a girl she is. Not my daughter, obviously, but I am using my words to lift her up in everybody else's eyes. Right? When I walk through, I can't speak that. That's me personally. But so I use my lips to praise an individual. When I'm offering my sacrifices to God, the calves of my lips, so to speak, as Hosea uses, the fruit of my lips, I'm lifting him up. Say, here is my offering. But it's a continuous process, continuous cycle. Now, mind you, Hosea is not referring to sins, transgressions, iniquities, rather just praises. The sins, transgressions, iniquities are a different problem. That's a different story. We'll discuss that later on in the Torah portion of Leviticus. But we understand these details that God has this altar, has its functions, has its uses, its purpose. And to not forget what they're used for. They're important to understand their symbolisms because he speaks to us in symbols. Not through straight words all the time. He uses symbols to show pictures. And pictures help us understand the depths of how he sees stuff. So Ariel, Jerusalem, Ariel, the altar. I'm in that altar too. I'm inside of it, just like you are. I'm on in that altar with the whole fire and everything else, because it's also the whole of Jerusalem. I want to be there. It's like you want to be there. That altar is part of us. It's part of who we're going to dwell and live. The line of God. Make sense? Any questions or comments about this Torah portion? Yes, Jared.
I guess you could say the design of Jerusalem, the temple, and the altar are very right.
Yes, very right. Any questions or comments? Oh, yes.
Just thinking about the more encompass of the temple service and bringing the tithe and the function of the tithe, the fathers, the poor, and the widow, right? So this part of also just sacrificing and, yes, give praise to God. Yes, what we do, the goal at least, right, is until Christ be formed in us. is to perhaps with our hands and our feet and our mouth and as a witness going to the suffering and that being a tithe as well. Does that make sense?
Okay. Let me back a little bit here. The focus of this Torah portion study was the altar specifically. All right. So each component that God has, whether it be the menorah, whether it be the incense, the ark, the drapes, the boards, the metals used, they all have their symbols and purposes. So they each have their designated use and function. So when I think of and contemplate the altar, I'm thinking of it contemplating the structure where I give my best to God, as well as the structure I give my corrections that I must correct myself before God to. The altar is both things. That's what gives you my rightness, my strength, my uprightness with God. I show what I did wrong. I explain, yes, I confess, I screwed up. Here's what it is. As well as the God, thank you for the great blessing you've given to me, which include some tithe offerings as well. Those are also some of the 10th one, not the best, it's just the 10th one. But it's also given too. The altar is used for that purpose. Now, what does that look like or translate to a modern day world? Because I don't have a physical structure to offer. I don't even have a goat or whatever else to offer if I did have an animal. I don't have those things to offer. Well, I had to focus on, okay, what does Zechariah explain in 14 for us what it's supposed to be? I give my glory, I give my honor to God in that altar. So when I give my glory, who do I glorify for everything I do? I give it to God. What do I give my honor to everything? Why I do everything? I give it to God. I'm always giving it and giving God those great things. So how do I give glory and honor, to use the example of joy, to a thing? Well, I give it to a person by using my words. So my glory and honor in the altar, I have to use my words and my actions that show this, that correlate with them. So those are all oriented according to God. So I am successful in XYZ because God has done this for me. I have done these great things because God has done this for me. God has given the glory and honor for all things you do. That is your offering, sacrifice. That's the best you can have. It is you're using your words and your actions to correlate to what you are giving honor to. When it comes to tithing is a little bit more complex because that's not just given to God only. That's also divvied up between the poor, the fatherless, the widow. Those are different things. They're different applications. We're focusing solely on the altar itself, what it receives. You yourself, now we know what your words must be like and your actions must be like according to the altar is required, what it expects from you. Now, to go beyond that, with the poor, the fatherless, and the widow, this is not really the altar anymore. This is now about what you are doing, not just the altar, but to other people, to other individuals, to help them out, to be a reflection of God in you to them. So you're doing this to God, but now you have to reflect Him to others. Does that make sense? So that is a translation of what I did here. Now I'm going to mimic that concept to all these other categories God is expecting of me. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions or comments? I took you over time. I apologize for that. I didn't even know what time it is because the clock's messed up. I'll just point to that, say that's the fault. So let's conclude with a prayer. Almighty God, our great Father, thank you for our Shabbat, our day of rest, our day of time to worship and praise and study your ways. Father, continue to help us to enlighten our hearts and our minds that we understand you deeper with more purpose, with greater wisdom. But we ask you will grant us to be peaceful servants, good people to you. We ask you will grant us kindness and love to share with others. We ask your blessing, Father, rest for Shabbat, our day of rest. In Yeshua's name, amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at Hallel.info. That's Hallel.info. Hallel.info.